expecting someone important looking, but I didn't think you'd be this pretty.
The woman just stared unblinkingly at the beastkin, almost as if she doubted whether the girl was an illusion of some sort. What sort of behavior was this? Was this whelp before her unable to grasp greatness when she saw it?
I mean, between you and me?
The redhead lowered her voice.
He's getting on in years a little, you know? I think his friend Lictor looks much better. Not that he's my type or anything, but he's quite handsome, isn't he?
Imril finally blinked, and then continued to do so rapidly as she struggled to wrap her head around the ever-shifting topic of conversation.
So I heard you were, like, a super famous wizard, right? Say, you can shoot lightning out of your eyes, right? Can you show me? I always wanted to see someone shoot eye lightning.
The cat girl practically bounced in place with anticipation by this point, in stark contrast to Boxy's internalized panic. The chest-minded monster had no idea it would meet her face-to-face like this, so it had no other choice but to lay the act on thick. It didn't even try to make friends with her, as there was no way this prideful snob would get along with someone as happy-go-lucky and bubbly as Kira. Staying in character at this point was more important than getting on Imril's good side, especially since both Underwood and his superiors had their eye on the freshly promoted Decanus. Besides, even if she was, by all accounts, a colossal bitch, the High Elf Wizard was not the type of person that would vaporize someone just because they seemed rude and ignorant.
Ha-ahem!
One of the soldiers loudly cleared his throat.
Decanus Morgana, ma'am. I think it's about time we set off.
The Beastkin was, technically speaking, in command of this little operation. The Sandman explicitly requested her presence, and she was one of the very few people to have met him. In short, this made Kira the closest thing the Republic had to an expert on the masked figure. She also technically outranked the more senior legionnaire who spoke to her, even if slightly. It was hardly a surprise that the man was as respectful to his superior officer as possible, as were his comrades. That was only on the outside, of course. Inwardly, they were all dreading having someone like Kira in command. It wasn't because she was an adventurer, but because she seemed rather nutty. They were about to walk into a potentially lethal confrontation with a dubious mercenary, and yet the girl acted as if she was getting ready for a casual picnic.
Hmm? Oh, right, sorry. I just got a little overexcited meeting Miss Imril in person. I heard so much about her at the guild.
It's understandable, ma'am, but we really should be on our way.
Yes, of course.
The cat girl coughed once or twice to rein in her mock enthusiasm, then asked the soldier who addressed her earlier.
Then you have the package?
Right here, ma'am.
The soldier gestured towards the man immediately behind him, who carried a sturdy-looking metal chest locked up with a heavy padlock.
Very good. Primus Underwood also mentioned a special gift of some kind. Where's that?
I believe that is in Lady Imiril's possession, ma'am.
Those words snapped the needlessly haughty High Elf out of her stunned silence.
Indeed it is,
she declared in a grandiose fashion.
However, its identity is not for one of your stature to know.
All right, then let's move out, everybody.
Relieved to finally have some coherent orders, the soldiers assumed a loose, square-like formation with Kira, Imiril, and the locked chest at the center, then moved out through the front gates. The hilt tree mentioned in the invoice was one of the oldest trees in the region and a well-known landmark. It was also about 20 kilometers south of the fort, so the group would normally have a long march ahead of them if Imiril wasn't there. Once the patrol was out of the front gates and a good 300 or so meters away from the fort, the high-level wizard started casting a grand spell.
Gate!
A circular, magical doorway sprang out of thin air, one that was almost as big as the fort's main entrance. The scenery beyond the portal was that of a grassy plain, with an impossibly tall tree visible in the distance. One by one, the soldiers strode through the gate as if it were an everyday occurrence. There was hardly any resistance, not even a peculiar sensation as Kira passed through it. It was as natural and effortless a transition as going from one room to the other. Imiril, who was busy maintaining the portal, was the last one to go through before it collapsed in on itself. All things said and done, they appeared a distance that was less than 10 minutes away on foot from the tree. It was possible to transfer everyone directly under the tree's canopy, but that might have been considered a hostile action by the other party. As for why they had to step away from the fort, there was a powerful ward around the place that interfered with most forms of spatial magic. It was standard procedure to fortify a stronghold against teleportation, otherwise they ran the risk of the enemy transporting their forces directly inside the fort and bypassing the walls entirely. This bit of trivia came as a surprise to Boxy, since Transfamiliar worked just fine within the fort's confines. Then again, the laws of magic governing that particular spell were different from those employed by a wizard's spatial manipulation, so it made sense in its own way. It was a very welcome discovery, because it meant that the shapeshifter held an edge in mobility its allies might not anticipate. The armed escort resumed their formation and approached the 500-meter-tall tree warily. The wizard deployed a transparent bubble around them, a barrier of some kind that would protect them from any incoming magical attacks. They raised their guard even further as they entered the shadow of the tree's vast canopy, but there was still no sign of life. At least, not until they got within a dozen or so meters from the tree's massive trunk.
Who goes there?
A woman's voice rolled in from above, causing the soldiers as well as Imiril to brace themselves for attack. However, nothing happened for the next 30 seconds, nor did anyone raise their voice. At least not until one of the men gently ribbed a certain cat girl with his elbow, reminding her she was in charge.
Hello there. I'm Kira. I'm here to see Mr. Sandman.
Do you have an appointment or something?
Yes. We're here to deliver payment for, services rendered.
Ah, you must be the kitty I was told about. What are those angry-looking men and that old hag? They're your mates.
Old hag?
Imiril muttered under her breath.
Yeah, they're my escort. They won't attack. So, can I please speak to Mr. Sandman?
I was told to permit you and you alone. The others must leave my shadow if you wish for an audience.
Then, it's okay if the others step back a bit, right? Okay, everyone. Let's-
Nonsense!
Imiril stepped in.
I shall not let this poor child be taken in by such petty tricks. Show yourself!
I'm already in front of you, you old bat! Are your eyes just for decoration? Or do you perhaps need glasses in your old age?
Dispel!
No, wait!
Kira tried to stop the enraged elf, but it was too late. An invisible wave of magic exploded out of the wizard's outstretched hand and washed over her surroundings. It was a spell meant to negate ongoing magical effects by forcibly dispersing the mana holding them together. She expected to hit someone cloaked in invisibility or hiding behind an illusion of some sort, but ended up with a completely different response.
Oi! That hurt, you uppity cunt!
A snake-like root sprouted out from the ground beneath her feet and delivered a splendid uppercut-like blow to the high elf's chin, knocking her into the air. A countless number of other, smaller roots sprouted out from the grassy soil, firmly entangling the entire platoon and forcing them to the ground before they could do anything. Only Imiril managed to escape by flying up into the air with her magic. A number of green vines shot out horizontally from the tree's thick trunk, firmly wrapping themselves around her hands, feet, mouth, and throat. Not only was she unable to chant, but she immediately felt her MP drain away at a rapid pace. Those parasitic plants sucked her magical reserves completely dry within seconds and slammed her into the ground like a comatose fish. This left the pompous wizard in the same helpless predicament as the others. Having been singled out, the wizard was dragged across the dirt until she was at the very foot of the hilt tree. It was then that the dryad residing within the venerable plant finally showed herself. The green-skinned woman walked out of the bark as if it were a curtain, causing everyone present to stare at her with wide-open eyes. She was much younger than Ambrosia, so her proportions were not quite as voluptuous. In fact, her appearance was like someone in her late teens, much closer to Kira's modest proportions. She had the same hair-like vines growing out of her scalp as Ambrosia, although her lack of antlers was, according to the Elder Dryad, a sign that she had not matured fully. The tempestuous tree spirit silently looked over everyone present before turning her attention to the uppity cunt at her feet. She squatted down and glared at her with a look that could kill.
Why the fuck did you just disperse the mana inside my trunk, you twat?
She said in a clearly pissed-off tone.
I need that shit to live! Do you have any idea how painful that was? No, of course you don't. You hoity-toity, smart-assed, stick-twirling, twinkle fingers are all the same. You think you're all that just because you can conjure a few sparks? Well, guess what? You're not the top bitch round here. I am!
The furious dryad took a few deep breaths as she let her tirade peter off.
It's okay, though. I won't kill you. I'll just have to teach you a lesson.
A thick root jutted out from the soil behind her, and the dryad seated herself on top of it. She gestured at the vines binding Imeril, which dragged the powerless wizard closer to her and forcibly bent her over the dryad's knees. A few extra vines rolled up the hem of her dress-looking robe until her pale butt and lacy black underwear were visible to all.
I shall now begin instructing you on the 999 reasons why you should respect your elders.
The dryad then raised her hand and spread her palm wide.
Number one.
She spanked Imeril with all her might, making her rump jiggle furiously while its owner let out a muffled yell of pain.
Two.
One could see the shock wave of each hit travel down her thighs, almost as if someone had thrown a stone in the still waters of a pond.
Three.
The dryad kept slapping her hard enough to leave a bright red handprint on the nearly snow-white skin of the elf's buttocks.
Four.
To say it looked painful was an understatement, especially considering the tears streaming down from the humiliated wizard's eyes.
Five.
And, of course, watching this all unfold were the 50-odd members of Kira's armed escort.
Six.
The vast majority of them thought the arrogant bitch deserved it, as it wasn't the first time her spoiled attitude had caused problems for them.
Seven.
Still, there were some that felt bad for her, and that number only grew as the punishment dragged on.
Eight.
As for Boxy, who was still masquerading as Kira, it could only grumble internally at this development.
Nine.
These 999 reasons to respect your elders was definitely not what it had in mind when it told Snack to teach that impressionable dryad how to use non-lethal force. Part 2. It had been nearly 40 minutes since the dryad started educating Imeril, and she was just about done by the sound of things.
997?
The wizard's face had long ago become a sopping mess, and her audience doubted whether that red palm print would ever fade from her backside.
998?
As for Boxy, its only qualm about the situation was that it had to return the captive High Elf safe and sound. It would have loved to try and absorb her body if that hadn't been the case.
999!
That should have been the Dryad's final lesson in respecting the elderly, yet she seemed hesitant to let her victim go.
Ah, sod it. Might as well go for the big 1,000!
With a final parting slap, she tossed the sobbing Imeril aside like a filthy rag, released the platoon from their bindings, and calmly walked back inside her tree.
Now then, all of you except the cat, get the fuck out of my sight. You heard the lady,
Kira stammered.
Everyone else, fall back.
The soldiers gladly followed orders and moved away from the tree in an orderly fashion. A couple of them picked up the thoroughly humiliated High Elf and carried her off. They would try and apply healing magic directly to her bruised bum, but many of them doubted whether she would be able to sit down any time soon. It was almost a shame this mission was supposed to be a secret. they'd have one damn spectacular story to tell back at the barracks otherwise. Once everyone except Kira was a good 200 meters from the tree, they finally caught a glimpse of the so-called Sandman. A tall figure with a long, dark cloak wrapped around it dropped down from the canopy and landed with a dull thud on the grassy soil. He walked up to the clearly startled Beastkin, who immediately bowed and squealed out an apology of some kind. The Sandman just stood there and nodded a few times, after which they apparently began a proper dialogue. Or at least that's what her escorts assumed. Though the rangers did their best to listen in on the conversation, the most they could make out was some barely audible voices and no actual words. They couldn't read lips with their superior sight either, as one of them was masked and the other stood with her back towards them. This was, of course, entirely intentional, as Boxy merely pretended to have a conversation with the fiend posing as its alter ego. Underneath that baggy cloak, messy bandages, and sloppy face wrap was none other than Cora. She'd been instructed to break off her horns and tear off her extra pair of arms so as to fit inside the costume. The demon was currently pantomiming in accordance with her master's mental commands. She was unnaturally cooperative with this ruse, now that Boxy thought about it. Its demonology skill then reminded it that a demon's horns were a rather important thing, and arms losing hers had taken away much of her inherent aggression. This was normally a bad thing, since aggression was a fiend's main weapon, but it seemed to work out all right for this little play. A few more minutes of this farce passed before the catgirl-shaped monster turned to face the platoon in the distance and sent her second-in-command orders through Whisperwind.
One of you bring over the payment. Mr. Sandman wants to see it. Oh, and don't forget Miss Emeril's present, too.
The man looked towards the wizard to find her curled up on the ground and hugging her knees in the fetal position. Even if her physical wounds were treated, the emotional scars would take a while before they healed. Still, she at least understood the whole thing was her own fault, so she complied with Kira's request without a single word of complaint. She opened her item box, an enchanter skill that was nearly identical in function to Boxy's storage, and took out a masterwork-quality mithril rapier. It was a magic item she had personally enchanted and was no doubt the gesture of goodwill that Silas Underwood had mentioned during the briefing. The legionnaire in charge of the money took it from her and brought it over to the duo under the tree along with the all-important metal chest full of gold. Kira met him partway, around 30 meters from the hilt tree. Her eyes grew so wide at the sight of the fancy weapon that they looked like they'd fall out of their sockets. That was an understandable reaction. The soldier who brought the weapon over on his belt was just as impressed. To start with, the glistening white blade, intricately detailed spiral-shaped guard, and jewel-encrusted handle made it immensely beautiful. But it was no mere decoration. It was a light, graceful weapon that could be used for both thrusting and slashing attacks thanks to its magically boosted sharpness. The other enchantments Emeril had put on it were self-repair and increased durability, ensuring its edge remained as deadly as possible regardless of how much abuse its wielder put it through. The Beastkin took the valuables off the man's hands with a nervous word of thanks. She made her way back to the Sandman while the elven soldier returned to his colleagues with a bitter smile. That sword was probably worth at least 1,500 gold pieces, meaning he just finished handing over a total of over 10,000 GP to a complete stranger. Then again, it was never his money to begin with, so he didn't dwell on it. Besides, getting to see that lethal art piece up close was a treat in and of itself. The elven rangers kept watch from a distance as their red-headed commander unsteadily carried the heavy valuables over to the Sandman. She set the chest down in front of him, unlocked it with the key, and opened its lid. The Sandman peered into the steel lockbox for several tense seconds. Seemingly satisfied with the amount, the stranger gave a grand nod and shut the container with his armored boot. However, when presented with the rapier, he clearly didn't want to accept it for some reason. Kira fidgeted around a bit and flailed her arms around in a panic, seemingly trying to convince him to take it. She seemed to succeed at first as the cloaked figure's massive hand reached out and picked up the comparatively tiny sword, but he then immediately handed it back to her. There was some more arm flailing and head shaking on the beastkin's part that did very little to help the situation. Eventually, she was forced to take it back with her to the others while the Sandman picked up the chest. Some vines descended from the top of the tree and carried the tall figure off into the canopy, hiding him from sight. Again, that was mostly for show, as the gold in the chest had already been discreetly stashed away inside Boxy's storage. Kira silently rejoined the platoon with a deeply troubled look on her face. The soldiers had been mostly quiet as well, as they didn't know what to make of the situation. They didn't particularly want to know, either. They weren't paid to do troublesome things like ask questions. If anything, since their current assignment was supposed to be kept a secret, keeping their mouths shut actually meant they were following orders. The only reason the Rangers kept an eye on things in the first place wasn't out of curiosity, but so that they could react in case things turned violent again. It was a good thing it didn't come to that, though. The distance between them and their target meant that the things they could have done to protect Kira in that situation could be accurately described as jack shit. So, with their duty fulfilled, they propped up the still-upset High Elf Wizard so that she could open a gate back to Fort Yemen's outskirts. Once they were back at base, Kira marched herself straight into Underwood's office. The elf was more than a little surprised to see her return with the mithril rapier on her belt and asked for her report. Kira explained everything since meeting up with her escort, up to the point where they were addressed by the mysterious voice and asked to leave. Underwood let out an exasperated sigh when he heard Imrill lost her cool and unleashed a wide-range dispel.
"I knew I should have waited for Fayhorn to return from his mission," he muttered with his face in his palms.
Not only had Imrill jeopardized the mission, but she had also ruined one of his plans. The intelligence officer had secretly ordered his people to put a tracking spell on a bunch of those coins, but her rash actions had no doubt dispersed the temporary enchantment. It would have all been for naught, regardless. Boxy had picked up on the oddity in the gold with its magical perception before the money had even left the fort. Claws was more than capable of eating the tracking magic, if Imrill hadn't done it first.
"What happened next?" Silas asked.
"Well, the disembodied voice said something along the likes of, 'That hurt,' and then we were caught."
"Caught, you say?"
"Yes, sir. Roots came out of the ground, bound us, and sucked up our NP."
"All of you? Including Imrill?"
"Yes, sir. It all happened so fast that none of us could offer any real resistance."
"Was this the Sandman's doing?"
"No, sir. It was that green woman that showed up."
"Green woman?"
"Yeah, she walked out of the tree like it was nothing. She looked around my age and had leaves covering her, immodest areas. Oh, and her hair looked like a bush."
"Strange. I'm sure there were no reports of such a person in the vicinity. Anything else you can tell me about her?"
Mr. Sandman knew her. Seemed to be her boss, or maybe companion. Oh, he also said her name was Cirilla, and that she was a dryad."
"A dryad? Like the legends?"
"Legends, sir?"
The most Underwood, or anyone else for that matter, knew about dryads was that they were divine spirits that dwelled within hilt trees. There would sometimes be reported sightings of them here and there, but they were so extremely reclusive that very few people believed they were real. Even if they shared a world with ghosts, dragons, gods, demons, and all manner of other mythical beings, it was only natural to be skeptical of unfounded claims and old stories.
"Look them up for yourself later, Decanus."
However, Silas didn't particularly feel like explaining all that to the cat girl.
"Yes, sir."
"So then, what did this dryad do?"
"She, spanked Miss Imrill."
"Spanked?"
the man repeated in disbelief.
"Yes, sir. Pulled up her robe, bent her over her knee and everything. She wasn't holding back, either. Her butt shook with each hit, you know."
"And the others can confirm this?"
Yes, sir. We were pretty much forced to watch the whole thing.
I see. But why spanking, of all things?
I don't know, sir. She called it the 999 reasons why you should respect your elders, or something like that.
Silas took a deep breath.
She didn't really hit her that many times, right?
She actually went for the full 1,000, sir.
Sweet Nairi.
He pinched the bridge of his nose in exasperation. Humiliation like that would have turned that prideful woman into either a sobbing mess or a furious typhoon of destruction. And it was obviously the former, judging from how Kira was still around to tell the tale. A strong-willed woman like that would bounce back in no time, but Silas couldn't help but feel partly responsible. The fact that Imiril didn't know she might encounter a freaking dryad on this mission was technically Underwood's fault, even if he had no way of knowing that in advance.
All right, moving on. What happened afterwards? You said you spoke with the Sandman?
Yes, sir. The dryad released us from the roots and told everyone but me to leave. Mr. Sandman showed up once the others pulled back. I apologized on Miss Imiril's behalf and thanked him for saving me.
What was he like? His appearance, voice, mannerisms, anything you can tell me?
Well, he's super tall, well over 2 meters. Couldn't see anything of him under that cloak and mask, other than those weird yellow eyes. No idea what the deal with those is, though.
There's at least a dozen ways to produce that sort of effect, ranging from alchemy to enchanted eyewear. It's of no importance.
Silas dismissed her concerns.
You sure, sir? It was super creepy,
Kira insisted.
That's the point, Decanus. It's psychological warfare. The same goes for his apparent height. It's most likely magically augmented, or he uses some other kind of trick to make himself appear more intimidating.
It was possible that was the man's natural size, of course. The giants of Persepia typically stood 3 meters tall, so an offspring between them and an elf or human would theoretically have Sandman-like proportions. However, giants were quite rare, and half-breeds with them were even rarer. It wasn't unprecedented or impossible for the masked vigilante to be one, just highly unlikely.
What of his voice?
Silas questioned.
In a word? Manly.
Kira firmly stated.
The sort of deep, smooth, unshakable tone you'd expect from Mr. Fayhorn if he were younger.
Underwood asked a few more questions regarding manner of speech, word choice, body language, and anything else that might tell him more of the Sandman's personality. Unfortunately for him, Kira claimed to have been far too stressed to watch for tiny details like those. She could only offer vague and unhelpful descriptors like scary, serious, and creepy. Her commanding officer was forced to give up on this line of questioning and moved on to the next part of the debriefing.
What of the payment?
Well, sir, he took the gold, but didn't want your gift.
The catgirl apologetically took the masterwork rapier off her belt and set it on the table.
I can see that. I'm asking why he rejected it.
He said it was ill-suited to him, sir, and I think I agree. His hand was way too big to grip it. The hand guard was in the way and everything.
So a practical man, huh? I expected him to accept it purely for its monetary value, but it seems he's not just some greedy fool.
You were testing him, sir?
Indeed I was. Actions speak louder than words, Decanus, and the fact he didn't blindly pocket it is very promising indeed.
Boxy had not considered this in the slightest. In fact, it had every intention of keeping the shiny weapon, albeit in a slightly different fashion.
Decanus Morgana, what did you do?
The way the catgirl shifted uncomfortably in her seat while her eyes desperately avoided Underwood's was more or less the same as holding up a giant, flashing, guilty sign above her head.
I panicked,
she admitted.
I said I was under orders to deliver it to him, and that I wouldn't leave until he took it. I immediately realized how stupid that was, but it convinced him to accept it.
Then why is it here on my desk, Decanus?
The Beastkin did her best to avoid Silas's piercing gaze as she whispered her reply.
He gifted it back to me.
This was Boxy's true intention. It wanted Kira to use this wonderful weapon. It was so incredibly shiny that it wanted to have it nearby at all times. That, and having the Beastkin learn swordplay, was a perfect excuse to seek out a melee-oriented job. There was a high probability the elves would just take the weapon back and lock it up somewhere, but it had some sound arguments prepared should that happen. After all, Sandman and Kira would most likely meet again, and the former would be very upset if he found out his gift was forcibly taken from its rightful owner. Something like that would surely put a damper on the good relations the gift was meant to secure. However, Silas's reaction was outside the scope of Boxy's expectations. He didn't scowl, sigh, or get angry. Quite the opposite, in fact.
Huh!
It was a full-blown, hearty laugh, probably the first one he'd had in a long time. A few tears even welled up in the corner of his eyes as he pounded on his desk with his fist. The troubled Kira had no idea how to react, so she just stood there with an uneasy look on her face. The intelligence officer calmed down a short while later with a long, drawn-out sigh.
He read me,
he said with a hint of admiration in his voice, staring off beyond the horizon.
No, you're definitely misunderstanding something, Boxy retorted inside its head.
He totally saw through me, didn't he?
Definitely had no idea what you were up to.
This is like he accepted our gratitude without taking our gifts.
You can shove your gratitude up your ass. I just wanted the shiny things.
I bet he even told you something like, you need this more than I do, or use this to better protect yourself and those you love.
Nope. It was just an excuse to let Kira keep the shiny thing.
He's testing me in return. I know it.
The only thing I want to test is your flavor.
Something like, let's see if you value your people or your things.
Things are more valuable than people, though. Unless they're shiny like Fizzy, or tasty like Snack. Ah, but those technically aren't people.
Not to mention he has a dryad bound to his service.
That's mostly because she's an idiot like her mother.
This Sandman likely has a much keener mind than I originally assumed. I bet there's a deeper intent behind every move he makes.
No. See, the whole reason I'm doing this is to get you to pay me for eating tasty things.
Have it his way, then. Decanus Morgana, you can keep that blade as a token of your benefactor's goodwill.
Okay, I like him. I'll eat him last when the time comes.
Use it with pride.
Oh, right. Time to get back into character.
But, sir, I don't even know how to use a sword.
Then you will learn, Silas said matter-of-factly.
But this is too much. I can't possibly accept...
You will wield that blade and you will like it. This is an order, not a request, Decanus.
Yes, sir.
Now that that particular matter was settled, Boxy decided to put some distance between Kira and Sandman.
Ah, sir, I almost forgot. He said to give you this.
The catgirl dug around her pockets for a bit before bringing out a blue, cubic calm crystal.
Oh? He left us with a way to contact him, huh?
The elf mused.
How very generous. There's just one problem.
The item's inner blue glow flickered pathetically like a candle in the breeze, a clear sign that its other half was out of reach. There was no mystery as to why that was. Silas recognized this model as a relatively cheap one that anyone could buy. It worked much the same way as the military-grade comm crystals his recon teams were issued, but only had about a tenth of the maximum range. Of course, it wouldn't be able to reach the other one, which was presumably more than 20 kilometers away atop a dryad's hilt tree. In actuality, the other comm crystal was out of range because it was in Boxy's storage, but Underwood's concern was something else entirely.
Decanus, did he give you a password?
It was impossible to activate the item on their side without speaking the necessary keywords. They could respond to any communication attempts, but not initiate them.
No, he didn't, sir.
So that's how it is, huh? Don't call us, we'll call you. As expected, a careful individual.
The man once again stared off into the distance as if he just saw a mountain he had to climb. This overly dramatic gesture caused Boxy to silently label him as a moron who got needlessly motivated over unimportant things. A few moments later, Underwood turned his attention back to Kira.
That will be all. Good work today, Decanus.
Thank you, sir.
Also, I suggest you actually learn how to wield this, he said, gesturing to the rapier on his desk. Using it as just a decoration for your waist would be an insult to the weapon and its makers.
The news that the Empire would siege the fort within the week had already circulated among the troops. Thankfully, the Sandman's actions would likely set them back for several days, giving the Republic forces much-needed time to prepare. It wasn't a lot of time, but more than enough for Kira to grasp the basics of swordplay. Knowledge and techniques that would otherwise take months could be learned in mere days through the miracle of skills. The teenage girl wasn't going to become a master swordsman in a week, but she'd at least be able to put up a fight if someone cornered her.
Yes, sir.
Kira saluted.
In that case, do you happen to know if Miss Hilda is around?
I believe she's out on patrol. She should be back within the hour.
Thank you, sir.
She hesitated for a moment before picking up the weapon, then left the office with another salute. With her gone, Silas slumped back into his chair with a vague smile.
The dwarven instructor from the Knights of Alina, huh?
He muttered. He had intended to point Kira to one of his subordinates for training, but realized that would have been a poor decision. The man in question was a soldier first and a teacher second, which made him rather unsuited to be the Beastkin's instructor. Adventurers had to be taught by other adventurers, after all. Even if their jobs were the same, their perspectives and frames of mind were completely different. For instance, one was a disciplined, seasoned veteran who had more or less mastered the art of melee combat, while the other was a violent, swearing drunk of a woman with a penchant for needlessly breaking things.
Oh.
And Silas had just sent an impressionable young girl with a known taste for explosives straight to that monster of a woman.
I just hope the fort survives until the Empire gets here.
Part 3.
Nope. Not happening.
Hilda's response to Kira's request for training was as negative as it was sudden. Not to mention, loud.
Huh?
It surprised the redhead to the point where she couldn't articulate words and instead only made stupid, confused noises.
You can't go demanding a new job like that willy-nilly, you silly git.
The elderly dwarf crossed her arms. Okay, perhaps, hi, Miss Hilda, please teach me how to warrior, was not the best way for Kira to frame her request. Especially not when she made it the instant she saw Hilda enter through the fort's gates with her patrol.
That is, the training fee.
It ain't about the gold, you bloody fool.
The two's high-volume conversation attracted the bemused glares of many soldiers and adventurers alike. The gathering audience was something neither the dwarf nor her would-be disciple seemed to be conscious of. One of the spectators, a member of Hilda's guild, judging by his blue Knights of Alina tunic, stepped in.
Yo, boss lady!
He called out to her.
You're doing the thing again!
Huh? Oh, right. Oi! One of you lot go grab Jessie and tell her to come at the usual spot!
She shouted, and someone ran off somewhere.
You there, kitty face! Come with me!
The fully armored Hilda motioned for the catgirl to follow her to a slightly more private space. The two of them made their way through the space between the fort's inner and outer walls and onto the large, flat training field next to one of the soldiers' barracks. They went over to a corner between the building and the fort's wall, where Hilda finally took off her helmet. Her face was wrinkled, her hair was gray, and her skin was rough and craggy, but her piercing green eyes held enough fiery vigor to make the undead want to willingly return to their graves.
All right, lassie. First of all, who are you?
Decanus Kira Morgana of the 1st Scouting Battalion,
she answered with a salute.
You been playing soldier a bit too much, methinks.
I'm Kira, an adventurer from the Hidden Arrow Guild.
And don't you forget it. You need to have some self-respect for your roots if you don't want to lose yourself out there. Now then, you're one of Fayhorn's lot, right?
Yeah.
Then you should know full well ranger and warrior jobs have terrible compatibility.
Hilda was talking about how the two vocations were almost entirely mutually exclusive. Attributes, skills, martial arts, weapons, armor. Everything one job demanded was useless for the other, and vice versa. The roles they played, both in and out of combat, were also completely disparate. One could argue that a warrior's iron grip skill could be used to apply part of one's strength attribute to the damage of ranged attacks, but a single wheel does not a cart make.
I do, but... Okay, I think I misspoke,
Kira explained.
I want to learn how to use this effectively.
She unsheathed the beautiful mithril rapier from her belt. Hilda wasn't surprised in the slightest, as she'd pretty much guessed that was the cause of that ridiculous line she was greeted with upon the return. It wasn't like the catgirl tried to hide it, and the dwarf already had a habit of picking out every sword, axe, dagger, spear, and mace in her vicinity. It was sort of an occupational hazard.
Your conviction is lacking, lass,
she said in a damning tone.
You don't go around getting a new job just 'cause you got yourself a new toy to play with.
No, but see, I'm no good when something gets up close to me. I mean, I got claws and stuff, but that won't work on trained soldiers. What I'm saying is, I'm not trying to master the sword. I just need to be proficient enough so that I'm not instantly dead if someone snuck up on me.
Okay, that's better. You're still not cut out for a warrior, though. You're better off learning a rogue's trade.
That won't help me take down opponents that come at me head-on, though.
That wasn't entirely true, but rogue skills had too much overlap with what the mimic job was already capable of, and this seemed like a sound enough argument.
Aye, fair enough. Still, you don't really need a job if it's just swordplay.
It was an undeniable fact that the sword mastery skill could be learned by anyone, even monsters.
Miss Hilda, please stop testing me,
said Kira indignantly.
We both know a mastery skill by itself is meaningless.
Even if one knew how to swing a sword around, it was hardly enough to qualify them as a competent swordsman. They'd get demolished instantly by someone who had the right attributes and skills to support their fighting style.
Ugh, fine, fine.
The dwarf threw her hands in the air.
Leave it to that old shoe strap to get all the smart ones,
she mumbled.
Shoestrap?
Never mind that. Listen here, Kitty.
Kira.
Kira, right. I appreciate your enthusiasm and all that, but you're just not cut out for it. You don't have the right build, the right foundation to be a warrior. Your arms are like noodles and your body's too light.
Even if anyone could become a strong warrior in theory, some were far better suited than others. The job required one to forge their own body into a weapon, but the quality of said weapon varied greatly depending on the base material, so to speak. Yes, attributes had the power to make one far more athletic than they had any right to be, but there were certain biological limitations they could not overcome. One such example was that a beastkin female would always be inferior to a human male when it came to muscle mass, endurance, and stamina. That difference would only grow wider as both individuals advanced as warriors. In short, Kira would need to be a massive tower of a woman like Lola if she hoped to go toe-to-toe with the Empire's footmen.
Then, what about being a berserker?
The redhead suggested.
Same thing.
Actually, that one's an even worse match for you. You're way too happy-go-lucky to work up the right sort of temperament one needs to really master the job.
I can get angry when I need to.
Do not lump a berserker's unyielding rage with your petty tantrums, child!
The dwarf shouted with a voice dripping with bloodlust. It carried this supernatural weight around it that made one's blood freeze over. Although Hilda was a warrior instructor, that didn't necessarily mean she was a warrior herself. She simply knew everything there was to know about the job. Her actual occupation was that of a level 100 berserker, an occupation that, as she demonstrated, came with a few quirks.
It is fury that burns as bright as the sun, yet is also black as the darkest abyss. It rises up from the depths of our souls, trying to consume us, begging to bathe in the blood of those around us, friend and foe alike. In some ways, our worst enemy is ourselves.
Boxy legitimately felt a degree of fear and pressure it hadn't experienced in a long time. This feeling was amplified tenfold in Kira's reaction as the cat girl shrank back from the terrifying dwarf, shivering and sweating profusely all the while.
But we don't just let that side of us run wild. We cannot let it. So, we harness it, control it, nurture it, and direct it. It's a grim and violent path that muddles the line between men and monsters.
The oppressive atmosphere slowly waned away as Hilda reined in her boiling rage.
Think you can manage that, girly? No, ma'am.
That was the truth from the bottom of the shapeshifter's heart. Even if Boxy knew anger, the sheer pit of malice it just saw brought new insights into Korra's perpetually violent nature. Being a berserker was something that ran far deeper than just a collection of self-destructive skills.
I didn't think so. Anyway, on the opposite end of the spectrum are monks. But you lack the sort of discipline and pace of mind to make good use of that either. Being a paladin is right out.
I see. So I guess I'll have to seek out a rogue trainer after all.
That wasn't necessarily the case. The doppelganger could get what it wanted originally if it used a random disguise for long enough to obtain the warrior job as a fresh-faced recruit. The only issue was that this course of action would need to wait until Kira got back to Azurvale.
That won't be necessary, lassie.
Hilda's words threw its scheming mind completely off track.
You see, I had a feeling this is where we'd end up. Fortunately for your scrawny arse, I know a job that'll suit you just fine.
The dwarf turned her head to the side and beckoned over the woman who had been standing nearby like a sore thumb for the past while. She had auburn hair, brown eyes, a very slim figure, and wore extremely light armor bordering on plain clothes. She bore a large scar on her right cheek, and her otherwise plain face placed her somewhere in her early 30s. She was also human, which immediately prompted Boxy to start releasing calming pheromones to counteract its Butcher of Humanity perk. It didn't seem to work too well, though, as she still eyed the catgirl with a sharp glare. The shapeshifter silently wished for a way to turn that blasted effect off, but such a method was unlikely to miraculously appear out of thin air.
This here's Jessie. Ah, don't mind that mean look of hers,
said Hilda.
She can't help it.
Oh, so she's actually nice once you get past it?
Asked Kira hopefully.
Nah, she's still a massive cunt, but it's best if you try and ignore it. Watch your mouth, you old bat,
the woman growled.
I'll rip your damn tongue out if you don't.
The dwarf rolled her eyes at the befuddled cat girl as if to say, case in point, before turning her attention back to the matter at hand.
Anyway, Jessie's got an attitude problem, but she can give you just the job you're looking for. Just so you know.
The woman glared at the cat girl even harder.
If you want training, you gotta pay up.
Ah, if it's money, then...
Kira reached for the coin pouch she had prepared in advance, but the woman snatched it out of her hands. She dumped the coins inside onto her palm, picked out a total of 200 GP, and then haphazardly tossed the pouch at the cat girl's feet.
I appreciate your patronage,
she said with a rotten smile. She had no idea just how close she was to getting herself killed. It had taken every last drop of Boxy's self-control to keep it from lashing out, ripping her arm off, beating her half to death with it, and then eating her still twitching corpse whole. While it inwardly congratulated itself on not brutally murdering the woman, the dwarf moved in and punched her colleague in the gut, forcing her to keel over and drop the gold. Being struck by that heavy-looking metal glove was no different from being hit by a giant hammer, and it very nearly knocked the woman unconscious.
Oi!
Hilda shouted at her.
None of that!
She bent over, picked up the scattered gold, and returned it all to Kira with an apologetic tone.
Sorry about that. She's a bit of a twat. Well, she's still the only blade dancer trainer we have on hand at the moment.
Ah, thanks. What's a blade dancer, though?
This was not a job either Kira or Boxy had heard of before.
Well, it's probably best if I show you. Come on, Jess. Let's have a little spar for your new disciple's benefit.
I'll get you this time, you old bat.
Jessie scrambled to her feet while coughing profusely. She stabilized her breath and pulled out one of the two swords on her left hip. It was a saber, a type of one-handed sword with a long, thin, and slightly curved one-sided blade. It was quite similar to the rapier that started this whole thing, except that particular treasure of a weapon was straight and more needle-like. Jessie assumed a one-handed stance with her right shoulder pointed forward and her left arm behind her hip. It almost looked classy, if not for the sour expression on her face.
Adagio variation.
Her body glowed with a soft, blue light that gradually faded away after a few seconds while Hilda took one of the blunted training swords from a nearby weapons stand.
Right then, come at me!
The dwarf beckoned. Jessie lunged forward with a vicious stab aimed directly at the dwarf's unarmored face, but was avoided with a tilt of her head. The human clicked her tongue and stepped abruptly to the right while swinging her sword diagonally, but her blow was effortlessly deflected by the dwarf's sword. She kept making sudden, deliberate movements as she tried to poke holes in Hilda's guard. Despite her best effort, all of Jessie's attacks were effortlessly dodged or parried. The dwarf struck back with speed that matched the human's, which was surprising given her stature. Then again, Boxy was sure the old bat was holding back quite a bit. This wouldn't be a very good demonstration if the one showing off was knocked out in one hit, after all. However, Hilda's attacks were still as sharp and deadly as Jessie's. The blade dancer avoided them with minimal movements, either by stepping back or to the side. It seemed she didn't want to even try parrying or deflecting them with her weapon. This was probably a good idea since she'd likely be overpowered by her opponent's brute strength. She also tried to use the gap between Hilda's strikes to counter with a stab or slash, but those mostly just bounced harmlessly off of Hilda's thick armor.
Come on, Jess! This can hardly be called a demonstration!
The dwarf called out in a bored tone.
Get a bit serious, will ya?
No, she's already serious, Boxy noted internally. Seriously trying to kill you, that is.
Each and every one of the blade dancer's attacks were aimed at vital areas such as the eyes, throat, or the tiny gaps between Hilda's armor plates. Unlike her opponent, she gave it her all and didn't hold back in the slightest. Or at least, that's how it appeared at first. But the blade dancer stopped her feet abruptly at those provocative words.
All right. You asked for it.
It seemed she was indeed holding herself back somewhat. Jessie lowered her stance into a far more relaxed one while drawing the second sword from her hip. It was a saber, just like the first, only it seemed to be slightly shorter. She twisted her body around, positioning her left blade over her head and the right one parallel to her hip. She moved with such grace that it almost made her metal weapons seem like cloth ribbons.
Presto variation!
Much like before, her body briefly glowed with a soft light. Only this time it was a green one. The exact effects of those skills were unclear due to the weird words mixed in, but it was definitely a type of body-strengthening technique.
Dancing sword!
The next skill she used caused transparent copies of her weapons to appear out of thin air. They floated around her unnaturally as if held by invisible strings, but were definitely guided by her will.
Winterlich Waltz!
At those two words, Jessie renewed her assault, but her movements were massively different from before. Rather than thrusts or short slashing motions, she made wide, grand swings as she twirled in and out of Hilda's range. Her weapons left behind faint blue trails as they swung through the air and left a thin layer of frost whenever they collided with Hilda's armor or training sword. Her speed was noticeably higher, almost incomparable to before. It was at the level where Kira would normally see her as a blur that quite literally danced circles around her stationary opponent. Of course, the cat girl was anything but normal and could easily track her movements, though she doubted whether she could move at those speeds. Even Hilda had trouble keeping up with them completely. The dancing blades performed similar movements to their owner, forcing the dwarf to bring her large shield to bear in order to properly defend against the countless strikes coming at her from various angles. However, neither the floating blades nor the physical ones could get a clean hit on the veteran combatant. A few accurate swings of Hilda's weapon quickly destroyed those flying annoyances, but it created a tiny opening for the blade dancer to launch her next attack.
Blade Tornado!
At Jessie's words, both her blades abandoned their blue glow, and instead shone with the dull red light typical of most martial arts. The woman spun around on one leg like a human top, becoming a literal whirlwind of steel. Her attack let off a barrage of sparks and a chorus of screeches as her swords grinded against Hilda's shield like a high-speed circular saw, though the dwarf didn't seem to struggle in the slightest. In fact, she found a gap and swung her sword down onto the spinning Jessie, who had to abandon her technique to dodge it by a hair's breadth. The dwarf took a few more swings with her blade, but her opponent swayed gently like a blade of grass swaying against the wind. The unnatural movements seemed to ignore the way joints, momentum, and gravity normally worked and flowed into a sweeping strike at the sides of the dwarf's knees. A nasty scraping noise rang out as her blade cut through the gap in Hilda's armor, though it drew no blood.
Flamenco de Fuego!
Jessie switched strategy again, changing her movement's rhythm and flow. She moved with rapid sidesteps and made short, fast jabs and slashes at her opponent's face and joints with blades coated with a thin layer of fire. She came at the dwarf from various angles, constantly shifting her position. She seemed to finally be pushing past the veteran's iron-tight defenses.
Rose thorns!
She overlapped whatever she was doing with another martial art. Her right hand launched a barrage of stabs, making it look like her blades had multiplied. A few of the thrusts successfully penetrated Hilda's guard, scratching her cheek and singeing her hair slightly. This did not sit well with the shorter fighter.
Shield bash!
The dwarf surged forward while swinging her shield arm. The massive metal slammed into the blade dancer, interrupting her performance by sending her flying several meters through the air. She landed on the hard-packed ground, rolled over twice, and ceased movement altogether. Well, she was probably alive since her chest was moving up and down, but she wouldn't be waking up anytime soon by the look of things. Hilda exhaled before turning to face the blank-faced beastkin.
Well, there you have it, Kira. As you can see, blade dancers are a melee-oriented job that relies on swift movement and pinpoint strikes rather than brute force.
The dwarf put away her training sword and patted down the singed and frosted parts of her gear before continuing.
They also get some basic body reinforcement magic to use on themselves, and a number of other tricks to keep opponents on their toes. Those dances you saw let them imbue their attack with various elemental effects. Well, they're kinda weak since a dancer's intelligence is pretty low, but you can still nail a monster's bane or damage someone through their armor.
The dwarf glanced over to the still unmoving Jessie and turned her attention back to Kira.
Well, we got a bit of time before her royal twatiness wakes up, so I can answer any questions you got for me.
Are you sure?
The redhead warily spoke up.
Shouldn't we wait until she gets back up?
It's fine,
the dwarf said dismissively.
I may not look it, but I know quite a bit about that Prancin' Pratt's job. She's just here to give you the job. I'll be the one overseeing your actual training.
Or at least as much as I can. What with the war business going on?
Oh. Then, what are blade dancers best at?
It depends on the individual. But generally speaking, they're at their strongest in one-on-one combat. They can deal with lots of small fries fairly easily, too. They can also use those stances, or variations as they're called, to raise their speed even further. But their stamina and MP will disappear in a flash if they overdo it.
What about weaknesses?
Besides being grossly out-leveled by a dwarf ranker, of course.
Being outnumbered by opponents of relatively equal strength is bad. I mean, that's normally the case for everyone. But blade dancers have it extra rough, and something they normally avoid at all costs. Fighting stuff with long-range attacks or heavy armor also puts them at a significant disadvantage. But you can probably handle all that with your ranger tricks.
So, one job covers the other's weak points. I see, I see.
Mobility and precision were a ranger's strong points, but it was a job that was almost entirely focused on projectile-based weaponry. Bows, crossbows, slingshots, throwing knives, that sort of thing. By themselves, they were almost completely defenseless in close quarters combat. It went without saying they'd lose instantly if caught by a warrior, rogue, or any other melee specialist. Avoiding those types of jobs was easier said than done, because they all had ways of closing the gap between them and their target. Lola, for example, could use a skill that launched a harpoon-like projectile made with magic, which could be used to pull her and her target closer together if it hit. In other words, "I will be fine if I don't get hit" was a foolish sentiment among adventurers and monsters alike. Therefore, having a melee-oriented job that was highly compatible with a ranger's natural strengths made for a very attractive proposition. Blade Dancer was more or less perfect for Kira. In fact, it was actually better suited to her than ranger, given the shapeshifter's experience with close-quarters combat. It might have even picked this job for its alter ego in the first place if it had known about it at the time. Unfortunately, even Boxy recognized the catgirl's apparent build was ill-suited to being a warrior, so it hadn't even bothered to ask the Knights of Alina. There was no telling how long it would have remained ignorant to Blade Dancer's existence if it hadn't decided to ask Hilda for advice. As expected, the insight and knowledge of one who has lived a long time was a tasty resource to have. There were still a few nagging thoughts regarding that job, though.
How come I've never seen a blade dancer around before?
The monster was quite sure it would remember them if it came across them. Of course, trying to remember each and every person it killed was like counting the number of breaths it had taken, but it was sure a fighting style like Jesse's would stand out in its memory.
Dunno,
said Hilda with a shrug.
It's not like it's a weak job or anything like that. But it never really caught on round these parts. Maybe it's a culture thing or a race thing. But I just think that very few people around Azure Vale have the natural aptitude for it. Dwarves like me are right out. It's pretty popular among your kind of the Far East, though. There's a good chance your compatibility with it is good.
Ah, so that's how it was.
The redhead nodded.
Anything else on your mind?
Yeah. Was this spar really necessary?
The dwarf obviously knew the ins and outs of the job, and her words explained it much better than her actions. This entire demonstration was rather pointless in retrospect. It just seemed like harassment or bullying.
Nah, not really,
the dwarf admitted.
It was mostly an excuse to smack that twat about a bit.
I see.
So it was bullying after all. Boxy quickly filed Hilda under its impressively violent mental category and proceeded with its final decision.
Then, I want to try being a blade dancer.
Good choice. Well, I think it's a bit early for your second job. What time is it a luxury we have right now, eh?
Well, technically it's my third job.
Aw.
Yeah, I got the artificer job like 2 weeks ago from a friend.
Oh, so you're the Mary Popper I've been hearing about,
Hilda joyfully exclaimed.
Mary Popper?
Aye, the wee lass that blows shit up with a smile on her face. That's you, ain't it?
It would seem Kira had already gotten somewhat of a questionable reputation around the fort. It was an undeniable truth she spent a lot of her spare time making and testing various explosives with Fizzy's help, but it was hardly worthy of such a nickname. Was it?
Actually, this is a good opportunity.
Hilda lowered her voice to a more conspiratorial tone.
You think ye and your mate could hook me up with an exploding hammer?
What?
You know, just something that goes boom when you swing it just right, yeah?
Well, I mean, it's probably possible, but you'd get caught up in it too, you know?
Even Boxy was especially careful with bombs and grenades. Metal shrapnel had a habit of flying unpredictably far, not to mention it ricocheted off hard surfaces such as rocks and shields. It didn't matter how high her level was, not even Hilda would get away unscathed from a point-blank explosion like that.
I know, that's what makes it fun!
For the briefest moment, Boxy felt something that might be called a genuine pang of sympathy for Fayhorn. Regardless of their species or motives, that elf still gave some useful hints that Boxy could genuinely learn from. It suddenly made sense why he never got along fully with this woman, despite being decades-long adventuring companions. Well, none of that was really a reason to deny her. In fact, Kira had nothing to lose from getting on her good side.
Then, as long as you pay for the material...
Nice one, lass!
The dwarf cheered and heavily slapped the cat girl on the back. You have suffered minor blunt force trauma. HP minus 29.
Yeah! Oops. Sorry about that. Got a bit too excited.
A bit too excited, she says.
Boxy internalized its discomfort.
That strike was strong enough to turn most house pets and even some bottom-tier monsters into paste.
Anyway, just send the list of stuff over to me later and I'll take care of it.
Sure thing, Miss Hilda.
While we're at it, think I can get a matching exploding helmet? You know, to give some real oomph to my headbutts.
It was at that moment that Boxy escalated its internal classification of Hilda from impressively violent to batshit crazy. Part 4. A pack of gnolls were busy digging into a trio of deer carcasses, the result of a particularly successful hunt. The camp was shoddy at best. They had only cleared up enough space to lay their heads and make a fire pit. They hadn't put up any huts or tents, so the only thing separating their sleeping space from the rest of the forest was trampled down grass and the faint scent of urine they used to mark their territory. However, their lack of shelter was due to their relatively low intelligence. Although not quite on the level of enlightened races, gnolls were at the very least still smarter than goblins. Of course, they knew full well how to protect themselves from the elements. Otherwise, their species would have long ago been wiped out by the harsh winters that plagued the lands of the elf-dominated Ishigar Republic. Although many monsters and animals hibernated during the frigid winter, gnolls remained active. They survived the numerous snowstorms and freezing temperatures by huddling up in small villages that consisted of burrows and wooden huts while subsisting on smoked meat and dried fruit. Which was why anyone that knew enough about the beasts would wonder about this particular pack's actions. Gnolls were not particularly big eaters, so the game they caught was more than enough to sate the hunger of the 24 individuals. Normally, they would eat only as much as necessary and then preserve the leftovers for the coming winter. Yet, the canine humanoids gorged themselves frantically, showing no signs of stopping as meat, guts, and bones were crunched and swallowed without any hesitation or thoughts as to their long-term survival. Although reading their snouted, hyena-like faces was impossible, one would still get the distinct impression that these things ate like there was no tomorrow. This hypothetical observer would be right, because in all likelihood, these individuals would not see another dawn. An arrow flew silently out of the tree line, boring straight through one of the creature's skulls and pinning his corpse to his comrade's shoulder. The injured gnoll let out a yelp in pain and shock as three more projectiles followed, reducing the total number of gnolls down to 20 in an instant. the biggest and burliest of them, who also had the best stolen gear of the lot, let out a howl and rallied the others. They all reached for their rusty spears, dulled swords, and crude clubs. Once armed, they huddled together in a tight circle while facing outward. They took long, deep breaths and patiently waited for death to come and claim them, much like it had the rest of their tribe. Originally, these gnolls had been part of a village. Theirs had been one of the bigger settlements in the vicinity of Fort Yemen, although mostly because there was a good deal of distance between the two. The gnolls had long ago learned not to tread near the fortress, and instead expanded their territory in the opposite direction. As a result of their chief's unnaturally wise decision, the tribe flourished, and their numbers doubled to about 200 adults and 30 pups over the course of a few years. That all changed 2 days ago, when that came. A sole female adventurer attacked their village head-on for seemingly no reason. Not that the creatures cared. Gnolls often attacked everything outside their own tribe on sight, and did not hesitate to mobilize against the intruder. They thought they would just crush the beastkin and turn her into jerky, but they had no idea as to the sheer terror that lay dormant in that small frame. That killed over half of them within the first half hour. Fighters, farmers, children, it didn't matter who or what, all were sliced up and devoured on the spot. Then, for some inexplicable reason, that disappeared into thin air as if it were a bad dream, right as that was skewering one of them on its sword. The surviving gnolls all gathered up and made a decision. They would abandon the settlement and move farther north. That would definitely return to finish the job. Not one of the remaining gnolls believed otherwise. They took what food and weapons they could carry and ran off into the wilderness without a second thought. They had the right idea, but their execution of it hadn't been fast enough. No less than 6 hours later, that was already hot on their trail. The remaining 90 or so gnolls desperately fought back as they ran for their lives. They split up, set crude traps, even resorted to poisoning their young and feeding them to that, but none of it slowed it down in the slightest. Little by little, bit by bit, they were all hunted down and slain. These 20 were likely the last survivors, and that would not last long. None of them doubted the identity of their attacker. After all, the ones that died moments ago were their only remaining druids and shamans. That, the thing that looked like a girl, always made a point of taking out the rare magic users among them first. Just as expected, that strode confidently out of the woods, and all the gnolls silently stared at the approaching horror. Crimson hair like a rampaging forest fire, piercing yellow eyes that barely registered them as sentient beings, a pearly white, crescent-like grin plastered on its face, a naked, slender body unburdened by foolish things like clothes or armor, a furry red tail that swished playfully behind like a reaper's scythe. That bore the appearance of a young and feeble human-like girl, however one looked at it. While not immediately threatening, the horrific gap between its appearance and its strength only made that more terrifying. Those tiny arms had literally punched down the walls of their village. Those small teeth could crunch up their skulls and bones as if they were dried leaves. Those frail-looking legs carried it with a speed too fast for any of them to follow. That soft skin that allowed no blade, arrow, or spell to leave a lasting injury on. That was an opponent all of them knew just enough of to understand they were no match. They knew it would come, that their comrades' diversions were pointless and merely delayed the inevitable. Their fight-or-flight instincts had long ago given up, as neither option would save them. Their time was at an end, and so they put all their remaining strength into enjoying what had undoubtedly been their last meal. The girl-shaped thing drew a long, white blade seemingly out of thin air. It gripped it in its right hand and assumed a sideways stance with its left arm behind its back and her right shoulder forward.
Adagio variation.
It mumbled in a sickeningly sweet voice. The catgirl-shaped monster kicked the ground, crossing the distance between itself and its prey in an instant. The rapier pierced clean through the skull of the biggest one, who seemed to be in charge. The others swung their weapons in desperation, but every single one of them was avoided with minimal effort. They knew attacking would have been pointless even if they lopped the thing's head off, but there did not exist a single monster on this world that would go down without putting up a fight when cornered. The girl thing struck out with its left hand, its slender claw-tipped fingers digging into the nape of a gnoll's neck as if they were pins inserted into a cushion. It withdrew them a moment later and did the same to two more. The three gnolls howled in rage and then swung out at their own comrades, cutting them down in cold blood as the catgirl's mithril rapier pierced skull after skull.
Winterlich waltz.
At her second utterance, that shining blade stained with blood gave off an eerie blue light, and the surrounding temperature started dropping in the next instant. She swung it about in grand, slashing arcs, encasing everything she hit in a thick layer of ice and turning her prey into gnollsicles, one after the other. Even the ones that turned on their own kin were slaughtered indiscriminately. All said and done, it took but a minute to turn all the remaining gnolls into naught but shards of ice. Well, except for the first one that Boxy had hit with its newly acquired Blade Dancer skill, that one had quite literally exploded.